We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. If you go into the produce section of just about any supermarket in the United States, you will find great mounds of fruit. Fruit now is something that's available year-round. It's quite affordable, and it's something that is easy to take for granted. Now, our guest for this part of Focus 580, Adam Gollner, author of the book The Fruit Hunters, I think he would say you shouldn't take fruit for granted because it's something that in our past is something that was very special. In fact, he writes in the book that there was a time when fruits were elusive treasures. He says they have fueled wars, dictatorships, and the discovery of new worlds. He writes, every time we eat a fruit, we are tasting forgotten histories. The book, The Fruit Hunters, is very entertaining. It's gotten really good reviews. It was first published in hardcover in May of 2008 and will be coming out in paperback next month. So it's something that you might want to take a look at. And as we talk this morning with Adam Gollner, you certainly should feel free to be a part of the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Also, you may email will-talk@illinois.edu. If you do that, it'll help us to keep it brief. And in fact, if you're going to call, we do kind of ask people to try to keep it brief. That way we can keep things moving along. But certainly questions from listeners are welcome. Our guest, in addition to being a writer, is also a musician, makes his home in Montreal, Canada. He is the former editor of Vice magazine, and he's also written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, Gourmet, Globe and Mail, Bon Appetit, Maclean's, and a number of others. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Gollner, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is a hugely entertaining book. I'm not exactly sure how it is we came across it. And one of my producers, I think, probably came across an article that was about the miracle berry, which is now getting so much attention. And that's the way that we got onto the book. And it has some really nice writing in it. So I'm glad you could be talking with us.
I'm glad to be talking with you also.
The part of the book, in part, it profiles some people who are, to say the least, obsessed with fruit, which perhaps raises the question, well, how is it that you got so much into this subject that you did so much traveling and wanted to explore and experience different things? At what point did you say to yourself, hey, I think I have a book here?
I would say that the moment that I knew I had a book here was when I was first tasting the miracle fruit in Hawaii, actually. I'd already been to Brazil, where I noticed that they have all these fruits down there that we don't have up here. And that was the beginning of my mind starting to wonder what it is about these fruits. Like, why do they have them, and why don't we have these incredible things? What's the story there? But then I went as a journalist to Hawaii to investigate that story, and while I was there, I came across this little red berry that they told me was called the miracle fruit, and then they told me the story about how this fruit had been banned by the FDA under extremely mysterious circumstances in the 1970s, and I thought, wow, there's a book here. And there are all these crazy fruit aficionados who are brilliant and know everything that there is to know about fruits, but they're also completely deranged and fascinating.
Just to stay with, well, to pick up one of those points there, I mentioned in the beginning that here in the United States, most places, if you go into the supermarket, you go into the produce section, they have fruit, and they have a lot of fruit, and it usually looks pretty good. But at the same time that we have that access now to a lot of fruit in it, we have it year-round, that is such a tiny slice of the fruit that the world produces. For most people, their experience of fruit is frighteningly limited.
I like that you say frighteningly. It's also, it can be frighteningly illimited or unlimited out there. I mean, some of the other people are kind of, some of the real fruit connoisseurs are people who have lost themselves in a void of limitlessness, who are just trying to understand the vast infinity of fruits that grow on this planet. So in our supermarkets, we have maybe several dozen varieties of fruits available, and they've all been bred to ship well and look perfect. And flavor hasn't really been a consideration over the past few decades. So we have these gorgeous fruits that taste like tennis balls in our produce aisles. But on the other hand, we have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of fruits that grow all over the world that never make it into commerce, into our supermarkets. And the stories of both of those stories are explored in The Fruit Hunter.
Yeah. Well, just to make one point, I guess the main reason, or is the main reason, that we don't have this amazing range that we don't get a chance to sample it is because fruits are perishable. They just don't ship well. And if you want to taste those things, you probably will have to go to the place where they're produced because they're not going to get here.
Hence, a fruit hunter, somebody who has to go to the source to find these things. You're absolutely right. They didn't evolve to sit for 3 weeks in a refrigerator in a truck and under neon lights. They evolved to be consumed in forests, in woods, in all sorts of natural places. And so most of them really don't survive shipping and the indignities of everything related to getting them into our supermarkets. But some of them do, and some of them don't, and that's the story.
Yeah. Just one other thing that I think is, there's just so many remarkable little details in here. One thing that I just really kind of grabbed me, and it goes to this idea of our limited experience of fruit. Even if you take something like an apple, for example, you know, that we have apples, and I don't know how at this moment how many different varieties there are. I could go down to our local store here and probably find at least eight, if not more. But the thing that struck me was this idea that there are so many different kinds of apples that I could try a different one every day and never run out. We would die before we'd tasted them all.
Oh, that's for sure. Because according to last count, there are something like 20,000 different named varieties of apples out there. And I think I did the math. I think it was something like if you ate a different apple every day, it would take you 54 years to try all of those. But that doesn't include all of the ones that don't have names and all of the new ones that are continually arising. Because every time you plant one of the seeds from an apple, it grows into a new, different type of apple. And so the only way to propagate them is by grafting them. The only way to get another Gala or a Fuji is by grafting it. And all of those seeds turn into something else. So there's this kind of built-in mechanism for these things to mutate and morph and evolve and become different things. And one thing that I find fascinating is that about 10 years ago, there weren't eight different varieties of apples in our supermarkets. There was maybe two or three, and then it was maybe five or six. And then I remember about 2 years ago, I was at a supermarket, and they had heirloom apples for the first time. And, you know, you were seeing them in farmers markets, but then you started seeing them in some grocery stores, and it just shows how things are changing and continually changing. And one of the hopeful notes that the research uncovered is that even though things have been quite bland up until now, as far as our fruits are concerned, as far as flavor is concerned, there's a very large movement of fruit breeders who are emphasizing flavor and who are creating new varieties naturally that we'll be able to somehow make it to our supermarkets while also tasting delicious. And we're still about 5 or 10 or 15 years away, but some of these things really are delicious and can be sold. And so there's this idea that once it's in our grocery stores, it's got to be bad. That's not necessarily true, and things will keep changing. And I'm optimistic that in 20 years, things will be very different from right now.
Well, does that, and is that driven by consumer demand, or is that more producers who have this faith that you know, if we grow it, they will eat it, and once they taste it, they'll say, "Whoa, this is a really good apple, and give me more of those."
It's driven by a number of things. I think the fruit industry, the really big mega fruit industry, is realizing that people don't like really bad fruit. And there's this idea that consumers can be punitive. Like when you go and you buy some cherries that are really bad, you won't buy any more cherries for maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month, maybe 6 months. You know, by then the season has come and gone, and those growers lost you. They lost the consumer. So there's this realization that you have to start delivering quality. Now, quality comes at a price, but there are people out there who are working on satisfying a consumer demand for flavorful fruits, and it's not easy. It's certainly not easy, and it takes a long time, but I think it's a mixture of many, many things.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Adam Gallner. He is the author of The Fruit Hunters. The subtitle is A Story of Nature, Adventure, Commerce, and Obsession. First published in hardcover by Scribner in May of 2008 and will be coming out in paperback next month. The book is certainly available now if you want to seek it out. Very entertaining reading. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I was trying to, as I was thinking about this, I guess I was trying to get myself to imagine what it would be like if fruit was a rarity, if it was something maybe you could only have a couple of times a year. And I think that it's hard for us. But I think you can maybe imagine what it would be like if you had a diet that was really bland and was really limited, and what you got to eat, maybe it was enough to keep body and soul together, but wasn't very exciting. And then if someone gave you an orange, you would probably thought you died and gone to heaven. And that's something that I imagine for a lot of people, it's hard to recapture that feeling.
I think that is what excites me about the whole fruit kingdom, is the idea that there really are these rarities out there that when you taste them, you undergo some sort of very profound, immortal sensation that you are somehow coming into contact with the divine or something beyond. And it's certainly an ecstatic feeling. And we can still have those feelings. You cannot have that feeling with supermarket fruits. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that you know, those grapes from Chile are going to give you a religious experience. But there are fruits out there that are maybe in season for a couple of days, and who knows where you are in the world. Maybe you're in the tropics, or maybe you're in your backyard, and you see a black raspberry or just a regular raspberry that's just one morning you have it straight off the bramble, and it just blows your mind, and you feel this overwhelming sense of surrender to the majesty of the sensation. And most of us have had that experience, maybe once or twice in our lives, but the fruit hunters are people who try to have that sensation frequently, and they will go to very great distances to have those sensations. But to me, what it makes me think of is like what you were just speaking about in the past, how if you'd never had an orange, what a miraculous thing it would be. And that's the way most of us in the West lived since the fall of the Roman Empire. We barely ate any fruits, let alone any fresh fruits. And so it was only with the Renaissance, with the nobility starting to say, hey, I want these rarities, these jewels, I want to taste these, that we started saying these are special. And then with the advent of refrigeration and mass transportation, we've got this availability of all of these fruits that are completely subpar and that are just not tasty and not special. But if you can get in touch with that idea that these things are special, and if you are willing to seek them out in season, locally, or when you're traveling or wherever, you can have these great fruit experiences.
Yeah. And I wonder, human beings are, we seem to be, our taste seems to be wired up so that we like things that are sweet. And certainly you can see that if you have a baby and if you drop a little drop of something sweet on her tongue, she'll smile. No doubt about it. And if you drop something sour on her tongue, she'll make that face that, you know what that is. So partly it must be that we just are wired up for things sweet. But is this something that goes just beyond the fact that there is sweetness?
I think the sweetness thing is a very huge factor. On the one hand, one of the questions I was always asking these fruit obsessives was, why do you like fruits? What is it about these things? And none of them could answer it. They were all just, so far gone. But one of them had a very interesting thing that he said. And he said, I don't know why I like fruits. Little kids like fruits. And there's something about that is definitely there. The fact that these things can make you feel like a kid again, which is a wonderful feeling. But there is something else that is perhaps more hardwired into our evolutionary mechanism. And it's a theory called biophilia, which means the love of life. The idea that interdependent life forms form a relationship that ensures their mutual survival. And so there are all these examples in history of different species that have evolved together. And fruits and humans in particular, well, fruits and all sorts of different animals, have a codependent relationship, and they need one another. And so I think there's something about that need, that without fruits we would not have evolved, that somehow comes into play, and that's on a deeper level, a more elusive and tangible level, but it's certainly real.
Well, it's true that I suppose part of the deal is that fruits make themselves tasty so that animals will come along and eat them, and then they will eat the seeds, and the seeds will go through them, and they'll spread the seeds around. That's a method of propagation. You might say, well, pretty smart of the fruits to make themselves so tasty. And maybe that also works with humans, but is there something more to the fruit-human connection than that?
Well, that depends on what your kind of outlook is. I think that certain botanists would say, no, that's it. That's the deal. You just nailed it on the head. Like, we are animal propagators. We are seed dispersal agents, and they have enlisted us to further their reach, just the same way that a bird does when a bird eats a strawberry and passes it through its intestinal system 20 kilometers away, and then news. Strawberry bushes grow up. I mean, that's certainly real. That's a fact of nature, is that the plants don't have any way of moving around other than the methods that they can devise. They don't have legs, but they do have beautiful appendages that are appealing to animals who like to eat them and then bring them all over the world. Or they have these little feather down attachments that allow them to glide through the air, or they float on ocean currents. That's the whole miracle of flowering plants, is that the seeds are ways of furthering the plant's reach. And definitely they use humans the way they've used other animals, which is, I mean, if you look at the vast fields of apples all over the world, or bananas, all you can say is these things have had an effect on us, because they're everywhere. They have been willing and malleable and able to satisfy us and do what we want in order for them to get what they want. And what they want is what everything in nature wants, which is to make more copies of itself.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose it's also true, too, in as much as we've talked about how breeding for shipability has contributed to a lot of tasteless fruit, it's also true that manipulation by humans has taken something that was an initial sort of the seed product, the initial plant, that was that might indeed have been virtually inedible, mm-hmm. just as it was, mm-hmm. and through selective breeding and improvement, actually taking that and making it into something much more than it was originally.
It's one of the great misconceptions that that I had as well when I started the research for this book, was that somehow wild or natural is better than what we have in our supermarkets or what we have access to. You know, that there's got to be these peaches somewhere in the wilds of China that are the best. Well, guess what? There are peaches out there that are mind-blowing, but the actual original peach is the size of a green pea, and it's completely bitter. It's like a little pellet. It's inedible. And it's only through birds and then humans and other animals consistently selecting bigger and prettier and juicy ones that they evolved into delicious, juicy peaches. And so we say, oh, wait, we've ruined something. You know, we've ruined the beauty of a Georgia peach. But no, we've just managed to create these ones that are rock hard and huge and look beautiful and taste like nothing. But the fact is that there's all sorts of other ones out there that are waiting to be created just by putting flowers together. Now, that's, you know, the miracle of all of this stuff is that these things arise in nature, and there's natural selection. Oh God, I'm not going to take us down that rabbit hole.
Okay.
But the point is that there are fruits out there that may not exist yet, that can be created naturally, that are totally delicious and juicy and firm and beautiful and sweet and everything. That are what we're looking for, or at least closer to what it is that we want from our supermarket fruit. And so the kind of idea is that we're not at some end point here. It's not like we have, you know, crossed some sort of bridge that we can never go back. You know, we've lost our connection to nature. No, it's always been changing and evolving and will continue to do so. And so in a certain sense, these things are really clay in our hands, which is what Luther Burbank, the great geneticist, said. He said, you know, we can mold these things. And just because some of the molders that we've had over the past few decades have given us really subpar commercial garbage, doesn't mean that there aren't other molders out there right now who are making fruits totally naturally that taste unbelievably good.
We are at our midpoint. Our guest is Adam Gollner. He's a writer and musician, makes his home in Montreal, Canada. His first book is the book we're talking about here this morning. And if you'd like to read more of this sort of thing, you look for The Fruit Hunters. It was first published in hardcover in May of 2008, but next month will be coming out in paperback. Questions are welcome, and we have some folks who'd like to join the conversation. We'll go first to Champaign in line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Nice to hear this program. The suggestion that we are simply there to convey the seed seems to me a very limited view, and obviously your guest doesn't subscribe to it either. It seems to me that, like marvelous flowers and birds, fruits bring something succulent and jewel-like, gorgeous colors and variety, and they're just rather amazing. Now, my family will not go with me to the produce section because they're convinced I was born to be a fruitarian and that really we do not have to have the very best banana in the entire city, but someone is going to get that banana. Why not us? So I think that the market usually ends up providing what you insist that it provide. So I'm very much looking forward to the author's view that in 10, 15 years that we're going to have additional fruits to be considering. It's going to be a fun book to read, and I thank you very much. When you consider that our grandparents and great-grandparents rarely had any fruits that they didn't actually grow because it was so uncommon for them to be where they could purchase them, and I feel pretty fortunate that we're in today's market. Thanks so much for a wonderful gift. Can he mention any amazingly succulent fruits, or did he do that previously when I couldn't listen? I'm going to hang up and listen.
All right.
Next.
Well, thanks for the comments. And can for that caller, can you mention some amazingly succulent fruits?
Well, there are so many. I'm going to say two fruits here. One of which is one of the fruits that is my favorite fruit that you will not in our lifetime. I don't think this will ever come to North America. But then again, the second one I'm going to talk about proves that I have been wrong in the past. So the first one is the ice cream bean. It's a kind of foot long or 2 foot long or 3 feet long green bean type of thing. It's this big, long green pod. But when you open it up, it's filled with a kind of cotton candy-like substance, this dense network of filaments of white veins that have this vanilla ice cream type of cream coursing through them. So there's this, it's like cotton candy that is creamy. It's totally and utterly mind-blowing. It's succulent, sweet. It's just one of the craziest things I've ever encountered in my life. And I remember when I tasted it, I said, there is not one kid in the universe who would not go crazy over this thing. Now, the problem is it only grows in Ecuador and the Amazon and a couple of backyards in Hawaii or maybe Florida belonging to these fruit obsessives. And it's just a very rare, special thing. Now, the second fruit that I also thought would never make it to any form of commercial availability is a fruit called the miracle fruit, which is, as you mentioned, the fruit that initially attracted you to the Fruit Hunter's book. I'm going to tell the story very briefly, just very, very, very briefly. It's a small red fruit the size of a cranberry that you kind of pop it into your mouth, you bite down on it, and it coats your tongue in a swish of nectar. Then you spit out the seed, and for the next hour or so, all fruit, anything that you taste that is sour becomes converted to sweet. So you can bite straight into a lemon, and it's this deliriously sweet experience. It's just better than any lemonade. It's amazing. Now, when I first tasted this thing about 6 years ago now, there was no mention of it on the internet. Nobody knew what it was except for a few of these fruit connoisseurs. But then somehow human ingenuity reared its beautiful head, and a retired postal employee who also happened to be a fruit nut in Florida said, if I start FedExing these berries to people, because they have a shelf life of about 3 days, but he realized that if he overnighted them to people, they'd be able to have a miracle fruit experience and try it in their own homes. And all of a sudden, it became available. And not only did it become available, but in the very week that The Fruit Hunters was published, the New York Times ran a story talking about the book, but also talking about what they called the flavor-tripping trend sweeping the nation about these miracle fruit tasting parties that are happening all over America. And, I mean, to me, it was very surreal. It was really like what the message of the book, it was the message come to life that things change and that when I started writing it, it was unknown and unavailable. And when the book came out, it was the most emailed story on the New York Times for 5 days. Like, how does that happen? I mean, it just happens. Things change. Things get better. Things get worse. They just change. And in our marketplace, informed consumers know that there are delicious things out there, and they're willing to pay for them. And there are people who are out there just getting prepared to supply those things.
Sounds dangerous to me. Could lead to dancing. We have other callers. Let's go next to line number two, and that would be Champagne. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot of fun. This is a great conversation, and it's great to hear somebody so passionate about fruit. I've done a lot of traveling myself and had a lot of fruit around the world, and the most ecstatic fruit and vegetable eating experiences I've ever had, however, have been right here in the Midwest. And it all had to do with finding something wild, whether it was strawberries on the side of a railroad track or, you know, wild carrots. Mm-hmm. But those were the things that made me realize exactly what something could taste like and how wonderful it could be. And so we don't have to travel very far to have these experiences. And sometimes wild is better. And I'll just hang up and enjoy the rest of the conversation.
All right. Well, thank you.
I can only say that I agree with most of that. I think that we can have these experiences in our backyard 100%. There is no... I believe that. I think that's true. I think the wild is best, however, is a question mark. Because those wild, that version of wild, is not some original version of wild. You know, that's still something that has been bred, whether it's through natural selection or even artificial selection, that somehow made its way back into nature. I mean, those delicious blackberries that grow in profusion in back alleys that I love, you know, the cherries that dangle off of branches into alleyways, you know, all of these things that are some of the greatest experiences that we can have in our backyards or in our hometowns, they're not necessarily wild experiences. So that's where I would just say that I guess I draw a line. But I do agree with you that you don't need to travel to... I mean, that's the whole point, is that they are all around us. They're everywhere if you just start looking for them. And there, I mean, just in your part of the world, there are people who are growing really, really amazing fruits that most people have never even heard of. I mean, I think you can get some pretty good pawpaws around there. How many people know what a pawpaw is? But they grow there. They're totally exotic fruits that grow there. And I mean, there's just so many berries. There's so many things. There's just so many fruits. So.
All right. Well, let's go on and talk next with somebody in Bloomington, Illinois. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, hey, thanks. Great program. I was thinking of your point where you talked about how animals or, you know, plants can't move and they use animals to help them move around to expand their reach of where they live and stuff like that. And I was just sitting there thinking about, you know, some plants. I mean, though it's not a fruit, you know, I quit smoking, and I just want to say that tobacco, when you stop using it, it makes you feel guilty for that, and it makes you wish you hadn't do it. And I had to cry like a loss of a good old friend at a funeral, you know. But other than that, I want to say I got some dwarf blueberries growing and some big bush blueberries, and I cannot wait for those to come in. And you have a good day.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, again, that tells you something about at least it's possible to produce great fruit in, you know, of certain kinds in your backyard. As long as it's something you can take the winter here, you're good to go.
Interesting point about feeling guilty. These plants can definitely have an emotional connection to us. Addiction is a big one. I think that a lot of the fruit hunters, a lot of these people who have really... they've gone beyond passion into a sort of obsession, a lifelong obsession, where they just have devoted themselves to fruits. Those people are in the throes of an addiction, and it's a subtle, unusual addiction. And it's a very fascinating one, and it's not necessarily unhealthy, but it is an addiction.
And is that a chemical addiction or a psychological addiction?
I'm not an expert on that. All I can do is hang around with them and marvel at their behavior, which is just utterly extraordinary, and write it down, but I can't explain it.
All right. Champaign County, next, line number 1. Hello.
Hi. I have a specific question, but I'll introduce the political dimension as well. But maybe I should get the specific. I drink a lot of dark fruit juice mixes, and I find that there's a berry called Avonia showing up that I have no idea what it is, so I thought I'd ask you about that. And, well, the other thing is sort of under the category of the darker side of the banana. The intro to the program mentioned the dictators and wars over fruit. And the Banana Republic is one of the sort of basic idioms of for 20th century, it seems to me, or basic notions. And it seems the case that United Fruit, which became Chiquita, it's actually not just in the past. It's Chiquita was funding people in enforcers in Colombia. But, you know, the main thing is the Guatemala coup that was engineered by the Dulles brothers, who had connections through Boston to United Fruit. So I'd like to hear you extemporize on that a little bit, if you looked into that. And it was mentioned at the beginning of the show, so I thought maybe you did would have something to say. They were basically nationalizing acreage that wasn't even being used for anything at the price that they were paying taxes on it. And that for that intemperance, the coup was engineered by the U.S., the original Banana Republic, Guatemala, which, and I think there's still some strains of Honduras domination that have to do with doubling the minimum wage and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So a little inchoate. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you. Great question, and certainly the only way to answer it is to be equally inchoate, because it's a huge, huge topic. I mean, the dark side of the fruit business is explored at length in The Fruit Hunters. The section is called Commerce. The book's a story of nature, adventure, commerce, and obsession. And so a quarter of the book looks at the kind of intrigues and the geopolitical machinations behind why, first off, how fruits get to us, why certain fruits are kept out of commerce, how it is that over the centuries, Western companies came to exploit the resources of the tropics for their own benefit. It's a sad, sordid tale. And yes, I mean, you get into the United Fruit Company and you get into massacres, you get into political dictatorships, you get into some very horrific stuff. And at first, I really resisted the direction that my research was taking me into, because I thought, fruits, finally, a topic that's just, you know, only the most beautiful things in the world. Fruits, they're so delicious. But then, of course, you realize that once human nature gets involved, it gets a lot messier very quickly. So I'm not going to get into a huge discussion about this, because we could literally spend the next week riffing on this. But let me just make one point that goes to the heart of some of the paradoxes that are out there right now. And I'm not saying I have any answers. I'm just saying this is a question that fascinates me, and that I'm not sure too many people think about. The local food movement has gained all sorts of mileage in recent years, and it's wonderful. I mean, it's one of these great realizations that we can have great food and fruits from our regions, and we can support farmers, etc. But then, what about the fact that we live in a world where we have, for centuries, taken fruits and crops from developing nations and have controlled that trade. And only now, at this crucial point in history, where they're finally starting to be able to control the exports of their crops, and therefore, you know, have some sort of revenue from selling things to developed nations. And what is it that they have? Fruits in the winter when we don't have any crops. And so at this moment where, you know, there's so many global aid agencies and UN think tanks, et cetera, who have all been saying that, you know, the key to economic success for developing nations is to be able to export, to have successful exports. And what do they have? They have crops that are fruits that we could be eating in the winter months. Now, at this moment, what are we all saying up here in the North with a capital N? We're saying, no, thank you. We eat local food. And so I'm not saying that there is any answer to that. I'm not saying that I have any solution. I'm just saying that there is a kind of a situation that John Updike would have called a mutual deafness. Now, I'm sure he was probably speaking about relationships, but in this case, you have people up here saying, I just want to eat local because it's better for the environment. But then you also have the economic realities of an interconnected world, and developing nations who, I'm going to say it, need our support and can provide fruits in the non-summer months. So I don't have any solutions. I don't want anybody to say this guy's saying he's not local, or this guy's saying I'm neither here nor there. I'm just saying that this is a paradox and a situation and something that is happening right now.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Adam Gallner. He's a writer, musician. He makes his home in Montreal, Canada. And we are talking about some of what you'll find in his book, The Fruit Hunters, a story of nature, adventure, commerce, and obsession, published by Scribner. First came out in hardcover in 2008, and next month will be available in paperback. And there's a lot of great stuff in here. So I would say go out and take a look at it if you can. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just to pick up on something else that the caller said, it seems to me that there also has been growing interest in a number of fruits that are very high in antioxidants, and people are looking at them as a possible source of, you know, now what we're calling nutraceuticals or functional foods or, you know, whatever you want to call them. Is there great potential, do you think, or are people looking at that kind of potential in fruit?
That's right. That was the first question, was about this dark fruit. I can't remember what the particular fruit was that he mentioned, but I'm sure that it's the latest and not the final in this ongoing wave of interest in antioxidant superpowers. And, you know, the acai berry is another one of those fruits that, again, when I first got interested in fruits almost about 10 years ago in Brazil, everybody there was drinking acai every day on every street corner.
Uh-huh.
But you couldn't get it here. It was just utterly unavailable and unknown. And then about 5 years ago, it started making its way. And there are, of course, some sordid tales in the world of antioxidant superpowers as well. You know, these kind of multi-level marketing plans where they sell you fruit juice on an installment plan where you need to buy 4 bottles of juice a month for, you know, a year or 2 years, and each bottle is $50. And, of course, it is sold with, you know, all sorts of miraculous benefits, you know, that these fruits will cure everything from, you know, baldness to impotence, et cetera. And people buy this stuff. I mean, there are people drinking dark fruit juice for a lot of money, and I got to say, I think all dark fruit juices, as long as they're not toxic fruits, are really great. As long as you're spending a few dollars, you know, we should be eating a range. This, you know, nutritionists say we should be eating a rainbow of fruits and vegetables every day in different colors. Mm-hmm. And once you get into the intricacies of antioxidants, you get into a realm of speculation where there's no proof that antioxidants are anti-aging or that they somehow will make you live longer, which is one of the kind of secret messages behind antioxidants. You know, palm wonderful pomegranate juice taps into that. You know, like you will live forever if you drink this stuff, or you'll live for however long you'll live. You know, on the molecular biology level, there is a lot of confusion and speculation about whether the oxidative theory of aging, whether it's even valid. And we don't really know for sure right now, but it seems that people are tilting in that world. I was just at a conference at Harvard with a lot of longevity. My next work is going to be on immortality, and I was with a lot of these scientists of longevity, and they were saying that the oxidative theory has been pretty much disproven. But that hasn't trickled down to common knowledge yet. I think what's important is that as long as it's not a poisonous fruit, that you should be eating all sorts of fruits, and they all have positive attributes and benefits. I don't think eating one of them is going to, you know, solve very big problems. But it's possible, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's mysterious. They're mysterious, healthy things. And, you know, one example of that is cranberry juice and the effect that it can have on bladder infections. And, I mean, that's interesting. That's a fact. That it seems to have that effect. Now, who knows what other effects these things have? remains mysterious and fascinating. And as long as you're not spending $60 a liter four times a month for the next 3 years, I think you should keep drinking them.
All right. Let's go to other callers. Champagne is next, line two. Hello.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the show. I've been looking forward to it, but I've been listening to David's blurbs all weekend. And I wanted to talk about some local fruits. Service berries are one that's local here that I think they're native, and they're pretty much free. You can go around and pick them. They're used as ornamentals by hospitals and the like. And then local persimmons. You can get Japanese persimmons, which are huge, in the store, but the local persimmons are much smaller, and they're very sweet, and they just drop off the trees and rot. And then as a child, we had fruit in the backyard, so I was able to go out and pick raspberries on a summer morning and put them on top of my Cheerios, and that's pretty sublime. We had sour cherries. We had quinces and gooseberries, which are things that most people here don't even know what they are. And then I went to Europe as a child with my mother and experienced blood oranges, which when I got back to Europe as a young adult, they never tasted as sweet as they had when I was a kid. And I remember as a kid I would get oranges in my stocking, and I always wondered about that because it seemed really strange. But when I grew up and realized that oranges to my parents' generation was an exotic, wonderful thing that you got in the winter, it was probably really expensive. Then I understood why they were in my stocking. They were no longer exotic when I was eating them, but they had been for my parents. So if you want to comment on any of those.
Yeah.
So many things to comment on. All of those fruits that are all around, whether it's June berries or somebody mentioned lowbush blueberries or May pops or mulberries or pawpaws, I mean, there's just so many. There's so many fruits out there that we don't know about. There is a movement afoot that it sounds like you're part of, which is this kind of urban foraging trend. And there are some organizations. One is called Fallen Fruit in Los Angeles, fallenfruit.org. They organize these walks through neighborhoods in L.A. where people eat fruits off the trees, because nobody eats them, because nobody thinks you can. And it just goes a long way to showing how detached we've become to our food supply. But you can find these things. I mean, one of my favorite things is when I'm in Los Angeles in the springtime is to eat loquats. Loquats are everywhere in L.A., and nobody realizes they're these incredible fruits. And so I think that's one of the great joys of living in a city is finding these little pockets of fruit trees and fruit bushes. And I think that people should be encouraged to do more of that. And if you know of these places and want to bring people there, I think there's a kind of community spirit of organizing these fruit walks that's happening increasingly. And I think it's awesome. It's wonderful. It's great. The oranges in the stocking we spoke about it earlier, you know, how oranges used to be this rare treat. Now they're everywhere. They're no longer special. But, I mean, the story my father told me was that when he was a kid in Eastern Europe, I think the top prize for the number one student in the school, you know, the top student in the graduating class, the prize that he got was half an orange.
Not even a whole one.
No.
A half an orange.
I think probably because the faculty split the other half. I mean, can you even imagine? You know, and for the kids, it was like, I mean, it was just the ultimate trophy. And how amazing! I try to put my mind in that place sometimes when I'm eating a fruit, because we are so jaded. And you know, and it just, you know, oh God, yeah, another fresh pomegranate. How boring, you know. But then, you know, you'd say, imagine I was in the desert and I hadn't seen a fruit in years. Imagine what this thing would be like. And when you get into that frame of mind, you start to understand why poets in the past had these rapturous descriptions of these things.
or why people would think that having fruit was something like a religious, not something like, that it was a religious experience.
Well, you know, every religion uses fruits as a symbol, and there's a reason for that. That's something else that's explored at length.
Yes. There's so much more in the book. So I would certainly suggest to people that you go out and you look for The Fruit Hunters by our guest Adam Gollner. First came out in hardcover in 2008. Next month will be out in paperback. Just real quick, we maybe have about a minute. I do want to ask you about this. I read that somebody is making a movie based on The Fruit Hunters, is that right?
Yeah, the Fruit Hunters has been optioned by some filmmakers, and they're working on it right now. I think that they're having the same challenge that I did, which is how do you get all of this into a story? It's just really it's very, very hard to look at all of these things. I mean, just in this conversation we've had this hour, we've touched on so many subjects, and only on a surface level. And so they're wondering how to take what is a very dense book and turn it into a film, and it'll be exciting to see how that works.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. I certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Perhaps when your new book comes out, the book about immortality, we'll have a chance to talk again.
I would love to.
You have any idea when that might be?
That'll be in about a year and a half.
Oh, okay. Well, if we're all still here, we can talk again. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Again, our guest this morning, Adam Gollner. The book is The Fruit Hunters, a story of nature, adventure, commerce, and obsession, coming out next month in paperback. So you can look for it wherever you buy your books.